Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Business Brew. This is your host, Bill Brewster. Super fortunate to be joined today by Shomik Ghosh, ex-Minion Capital, doxed himself. I can't say enough good things about him. We've communicated back and forth virtually. We were supposed to meet in New York or San Fran, one of the two, and then unfortunately 2020 happened. So that's happened to a lot of people out there. So we're doing this virtually, and hopefully it's a great time on the pod. As a reminder, none of this is investment advice. We're not your fiduciaries, not your financial advisor. We're not soliciting or offering any securities. So do your own work, get your own advisor, do your own due diligence. Shomik, how's it going, man?
It's going great, Bill, and thanks for having me on. I got to say, I love what you're doing with the podcast. You know, the first few episodes that you've put out have just been, you know, all remarkable, and you just... I think somebody else mentioned this, but you have the perfect voice. Like, it is so freaking good. It's actually kind of scary.
Well, maybe this is just one big radio resume for me. Who knows? If that's how it turns out, I'd be totally fine with that.
I'm saying that, you know, you got to get your Sirius XM spot, you know, and start doing this on Sirius Radio.
That's right. I'm just trying to be part of the big content grab. I'm real cheap relative to some of these guys. So if somebody wants me exclusively, you know, I'm always fielding offers.
Oh, that is that. Yeah, that to me is some of the most interesting stuff happening in the podcast space. I don't really know that much about it. I mean, I know what's driving it, you know, the margins behind it and things like that. But it's, to me, it's so interesting to see like Joe Rogan get bought by Spotify. You know, I get why Spotify wants to do it. I guess I get why Joe Rogan gets it, because he probably just got a large cash payment versus just, you know, having to accrue that over time. But as like a listener, it seems like a worse experience, because now, I mean, I don't know if they've locked it only to Spotify's platform, but if
they just did.
Okay. So if they did, like, I mean, if you're Joe Rogan, maybe you don't care because you already, you know, made your money and you already had like a large enough gathering anyway. But it seems like the reason he started this podcast was get more, you know, people listening to him and grow from there. And now you just capped your at least the ability to spread, right? So I don't know. It's an interesting phenomenon.
Well, Shomik, I think everybody is altruistic until $100 million hits the table.
No, exactly. I mean, that's awesome. Yeah.
Then maybe you say, you know what? I don't need as many listeners.
I would take the money in that case as well. But it is just interesting because I wonder, like, you know, like Patrick O'Shaughnessy, do you think he would take an offer from Spotify? Like, I don't know. I hope not, though, because it would really be crappy to have him, you know, and the knowledge he's spreading be blocked from everyone else to listen.
Yeah. So I obviously can't speak for him. I can speak for me. When I was thinking about what I wanted to do with this, I mean, first of all, somebody comes up with that kind of money, I'm whoring myself out. Like, let's not, I'm not at all going to pretend that I wouldn't. But it would need to be a reasonable amount of money, because the thing that I am trying to do with this podcast is spread knowledge in a way that I think is enjoyable and maybe unique to me being able to do. And the benefit that I derive is I'm able to get a lot of phone calls that I couldn't have gotten in the past. So, like, I wouldn't trade my network for money that wouldn't change my life. But if you're going to give me life-changing money, then, you know, there's a price on everything.
No, I think I completely agree with that. And that's the funny part about, you know, even why we engage on Twitter and do all this stuff, right? It's like the I think the effort that you put in, the payout is so remarkable after a sustained effort, right? It's you know, I don't know if we'll talk about open source software later or stuff like that, but like, it's kind of like open source software. It takes like 3 to 4 years to actually build the adoption, build the following and stuff like that. But then you start to harvest those sort of that early work in the out years. Right. And so that's why the payoff is, you know, year 10, year 12, like you get these huge payoffs in some of these companies because of all that work you did for that first 3 to 4 years. And I think the same thing happens with kind of these audiences, right? Like what you're doing with the podcast, what we do on Twitter, you know, what I did with my anonymous account and, you know, just sharing these ideas, investing time in it. You build this crazy network. You meet with people that like would have never talked to you, you know, ever before, but they're actually now evaluating you on your ideas rather than your title. Right. Which I think is one of the most important things that Twitter has done is gotten us to think less about, hey, this person's, CTO at this company to, here's a random engineer that's posting really thoughtful things. I want to go talk to that person because he or she is probably going to greatly increase my knowledge, right? And I think that's like such a fundamental shift that's occurring right now. That's really cool.
Yeah, for sure. And then the other thing that it does is you get these anon accounts and like they're, you don't know who's behind them, right? So there's no trying to get through a secretary anymore. There is my idea good enough to get to you? And if so, I've gotten some inbounds from a couple shops that like I idolize, you know, and when these guys have wanted to talk to me, I mean, part of me is like, why the hell are you listening to me? Part of me is really proud, right? I mean, I deserved it, I guess, in a way, but it's been really interesting to have those barriers completely eroded.
I love it. Well, I got to say also, we got to give a shout out to our mutual friend, Ord Falkowitz.
That's right.
It was so random. I think he tweeted something, or maybe you tweeted something. I tweeted something back to you. And then he tweeted something. I was like, how the hell do you guys know each other?
We grew up together.
But like great human being. So just to give him a shout out. Hey, Ord, if you're listening, we love you.
I hope he does. I need to get him on the pod. He could talk about building a firm.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah, it would actually be great. He has so many learnings. I think it would be pretty interesting.
Yeah, he is a guy that has quite a background and has certainly accomplished a lot in what would appear to be sort of, like he swam through different channels, right? And ended up in the – I think he picked a good niche. I mean, I think the results speak for themselves, so –
yeah, the SolarWinds hack is something that I would love to get his perspective on, frankly. That's like one of the craziest hacks. I mean, the fallout from that is going to be, there's a long tail to whatever just occurred. I mean, I think we're still uncovering what kind of happened. But these supply chain attacks are really interesting because you go in, you acquire a set of tool sets that help you unlock another set of tools, that help you unlock another set of, code access. And all of a sudden you're in, I don't know what they breach, but like Homeland Security or Treasury or whatever,
these yeah.
highly proprietary places, because you just went through all these different things that are all these dependencies layered on top of each other, right? Like the interesting thing about software right now is why I get so excited about studying and working on it every day is it's just these layers of dependencies built on top of each other that if one, it's like Jenga, right? Like if one yeah. brick gets removed, you can really have stuff where, not the whole structure will tumble down, but the whole structure gets a little bit wobbly, right? And what you have to do is like do all this resilience engineering and chaos engineering and all these little tests to try and figure out, what will truly destabilize it or what will just have it wobble a little and still keep its structure. But it's so fascinating, right? Because it's just all of these things as we continue to build more and more software are just dependent on Twilio's API, on AWS, on all these other dependencies. And there's no way for you to control that complex adaptive system, right? It's just fascinating.
So to a noob like me, because I think that anyone that's listened to me, I'm about to fully get exposed here because I am over my skis when it comes to software. But, when someone like me is reading about Twilio's tech stack and how it has no technical debt in it today and how like it's developed for developers by developers, I mean, is that should I be thinking about that as like the base layer that everything is going to be built upon as far as my best perception of that is a communication tool from businesses to consumers. Are they like the base layer and then everything's built on top of that layer? And is there anything that can disrupt that layer, like one step below it?
Yeah, so I think those are all great questions. first of all, I would say to say no technical debt is definitely not true. Like there's always okay. technical debt. No matter what you're building, there's always technical debt because what you're having to do, just like in business, you're having to make trade-offs, right? And those trade-offs come with, maybe you're prioritizing speed, but then that means you have to have less security, or you're prioritizing security, but then that adds cost, right? There's so many different components that you're always going to have some sort of technical debt because what you're trying to do is ship something to the customer that they need and want quickly. But you have to evaluate, like, out of all the other things that you're doing, you're also working on new product development. You're working on, you know, integrations with Segment that you just acquired. You're working on all these different, you know, components. You have to manage that engineering time and that resource. And so that's always going to lead to certain technical debt, right? Now, what's interesting about some of these later stage companies is they've gotten further enough along that a lot of those decisions they had to probably clean up earlier on, like they probably had to replatform or do things to reach the scale that they're at now. And so that's why maybe in some cases the level of you know, technical debt that will hurt the software and, like, you know, cause the business damage is greatly reduced. But the actual scope of that technical debt may actually be bigger, right?
Okay.
If that makes sense. Like, there may be more in this entire system, but the ability to take down the software is actually lower. But what's interesting from, like, a component from, like, the communication standpoint with, you know, what are people going to build upon Twilio? So the core part of, like, all these API first companies is they are doing something. They're taking something that you used to have to do and doing it themselves really, really well. Right. And so what business need does that solve? That means that when you're Coca-Cola and you're trying, or, you know, whatever e-commerce company, you're trying to communicate with your customers, you can either, one, build out that communication stack yourself, which means you're going to have to hire a bunch of people. It's going to cost a lot of money to do that. Or you can have Twilio do it and rely on them, right? Now, could somebody disrupt Twilio? Absolutely. Because let's just say, I don't know, somebody comes in and says, we're going to do this one WhatsApp API better than Twilio can, right? And they focus on that fully 100% of the time. They do that and they make it really well. Like, maybe that's what you decide to go with because of the latency reduction that they're able to accomplish or whatever. You know, there's some sort of key thing that they've been able to do. But in most cases, most companies will just look at, like, hey, they're offering a contact center API solution. They're offering video, they're offering messaging, they're offering voice. That's pretty good. Like, let's just go with Twilio, right? And so I think it's all about this end user, solving this end user pain, making the workflow really easy to adopt and to map with existing integrations and existing workflows that the developer is using, right? And if you can do that, you cement yourself in this new area of, like, product-led growth.
How much, you know, I mean, when you look at the valuations of a lot of these companies, it implies, I think, a pretty long duration of the asset life. I mean, one thing that I have stupidly argued against for, like, no good reason other than stubbornness is, like, oh, these may not be so durable, right? But when I think about it, like, software really is sticky, and I use some cruddy software that, like, it's just, like, in my life. I was reading not boring. I was reading him talk about Salesforce. I know it's one of your holdings. I'm sorry that I'm about to say this, but he was like, Salesforce sucks, but it doesn't matter. I expect it to suck.
Yep.
So, like, I'm not saying Twilio sucks at all. Please, anyone that's long, don't get all mad at me. But when we're thinking about these companies of today, and, you know, I complain sometimes about the SG&A, but what I pivoted on, part of the benefit of the podcast, somebody reached out to me. Like, maybe it is worth just this damn the torpedoes, land and expand, because if we can get all these companies on our platform and integrated and it's a network effect, like, maybe this time is truly very different.
Yeah. So I think
I know that you can't speak blanketly. I'm just saying, like, concept.
Well, so I would say valuation's a really interesting, topic in software, especially right now, right? I think if someone to say, hey, broadly, are the multiples in software elevated? Like, I would say the answer is absolutely yes, right? Does that mean, though, that certain companies won't continue to outperform? Absolutely not, right? There are certain companies that should get those premium multiples and probably will continue to command them because of the way they're able to either go more vertical into their offering and extract more value from those customers, or expand into adjacencies and monetize the distribution that they already have and start going into product adjacencies, which increases the TAM, increases the market share they can capture of the total customer spend. And so those are kind of the two ways that I kind of look at it, is are they able to do that? What's their approach? How are they approaching that? And so for me, you know, I think we've talked about this before, but when I look at valuation, with software companies, it's so funny because, you know, I'll give a great example. Like Everbridge is a company that's out there. And what they do is they basically create all the alerting software. So, you know, if there's a hurricane or a shooting or something like that, you know, you get that notification on your cell phone. Not all the time, but most of the time that's powered by Everbridge. That's something where, you know, it's mission critical. You need to alert your employees or the population of your city that something's happening. And there's no way they're ever going to rip that out, right? That's just something that just needs to work. What's interesting with a company like that is they've been growing 30% year over year for like the past 5 years. And so if you think about how our minds work, we work in linear thinking, right? So if you're growing 35, you should be growing 30, 25, 20, 15, 10, right? And at some point you'll have some sort of steady state where you're just having pricing increases, but like it should be this lockstep, right? And that's what's interesting is like, that's the power of software and kind of thinking about what can keep its growth rate at a above average level for a sustained period of time, right? And if you can make those bets, that's pretty interesting. So for me, I kind of look at a couple things when I'm looking at valuation. I basically look at, okay, what's the company today? Let's say it's, you know, 200 million of revenue, right? It's got 80% gross margins, right? I then look at, okay, well, our gross margin is going to go down or up over time. How do I think about that, right? Let's say they say steady. Then I would say, okay, at 80% gross margin, this business probably could spend 50% on you know, SG&A and R&D and, you know, G&A and all that, you know, whatever else they have, and still probably clear, let's say, 25 to 30% EBITDA margins, right? So now if I use that as my sort of metric, then I got to look at, well, what's top line going to be in 5-10 years, right? Whatever time frame I want to look at. If I do that and then start to say, okay, well, now what does it look like at 25% EBITDA margins and what multiple do I want to pay for that? That's how I kind of think about valuation. Like no DCFs, no, you know, stuff like that. This is just like napkin math that you can do. But the interesting thing about this napkin math is that it requires you to understand how is that durability of growth going to happen? Why are gross margins not going to go away? Why with those high gross margins is another competitor not going to go eat their lunch by reducing it, right? Like all these different things that you need to analyze to understand that steady state.
Yeah. I think that this is going to sound super late cycle and some of the people that listen to me are going to be like, what are you even saying? But I think that that's a lot more useful exercise. The longer that I've done this, the more I appreciate the power in just focusing on terminal economics and saying, you know what, like take Shopify, for example, right? Let's say that you can build 1,000 different iterations of the world and you're paying too much today in 700 of those iterations. But in 10 years, in all 700 of those iterations, you sort of outperform the market, right? So your real question is, am I willing to, and all you're obviously not, but for purposes of this, like the real question is, am I really willing to take the liquidity risk and lock up the capital to get to my end state? And then will I be right on the end state? But if you're conservative on your end state assumptions, then, you know, if you overpay today and it can still work over time, who really cares if you got to take a drawdown, as long as you don't put your life in, you know, in a situation where you have to liquidate prematurely. That's, you know, that's how you really lose there.
Yeah. Well, the interesting thing though is to start thinking about the optionality behind your implied bet too, right? So like if you're investing in Shopify today, they're like $100 billion market cap or something. I don't know what the multiple is, but it's some crazy multiple, right? Of sales, not even EBITDA, right? Yeah. But there's a lot of optionality that's implied within that valuation. And also one could argue not implied as well, because what happens if they're actually able to integrate in logistics with the money that they have? And by the way, they've been able to raise so much capital because as their stock price has gone up, they've smartly, almost had a little bit of reflexivity kick in where like, because their stock price is going up, they're able to raise more funds, which then almost kind of helps them achieve that outcome that everyone's betting on. Right. But that's really interesting to me is now if you go into logistics, you own that whole supply chain, you can offer a better customer experience. You can serve a broader base of customers And also, just like Amazon, you could start to earn margins in a different way, right? So maybe you lower your margins on certain one area, but because you know you'll make it up on, you know, the logistics side or whatever, you know, one of these other areas. That to me is really interesting. Plus, like the payment side, there's a ton of stuff they could still do in payments that they could innovate around that probably gives them, you know, a larger take rate too. So like there's some really interesting components to, you know, not just Shopify, but I'm just saying in terms of like optionality and looking at these sort of companies of, well, how could that change, you know, if Shopify is able to do this, Amazon is a $1.5 trillion company. Let's back out what AWS is, but let's see what they accomplish on the retail side. What do I think Shopify could do in terms to Amazon's retail side, right? And I think that's an interesting exercise that's just worth doing to understand what you'd be willing to pay for.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I guess that, you know, I've historically had such an aversion to things like, oh, you're underpricing in this segment. And I've viewed some of, I guess, the thinking that we're talking about probably more speculatively than I probably should have viewed it. I think if I had opened my mind a little bit younger, I probably could have made a lot more money over the last 5 years, but whatever. That's could just be late cycle speaking, but I think it's closer to truth than not. I have a question from my man, Rishi Gosalia. I hope that I said that last name right. I'm sorry, Rishi, if I didn't. But what are the common errors in SaaS investors' frameworks that they're making today?
You know,
Do you think?
Yeah, I think I honestly think what's happening right now is people are over-indexing too much on growth. Like a lot of people that I'm talking to are just like, well, we only invest in 50% plus growers because that means that, again, it's sort of that linear thinking to it, even though they don't realize it, which is like, oh, because it's 50% plus, that means that as it degrades, you know, it'll take them 12 years to degrade to 10% plus growth, right? But that doesn't still take into account that, you know, the company like Tyler Technologies that's growing 10% year over year could be making a ton of margin on that 10% growth that they're able to reinvest in acquisitions or share buy or whatever, other areas to actually increase the value in a larger amount than that larger grower, right? That may be just spending on customer acquisition and not really having that payoff. So I think that's the most common mistake that I see people doing today. Like there's so many blog posts out there of people who'll be like, you know, what's my enterprise software framework? And literally the first thing is like, it's got to be growing more than 50%. And I'm like, what? I literally don't understand what that means. So you're not going to invest in Atlassian, which is growing 30% year over year and is literally one of the best enterprise software companies of all time. Like what the, I don't even understand how you get to that thinking, right? And so that's the biggest thing in my mind. The other thing is I think not understanding the implicit business model bet that you're making, right? Like I'll give an example. If you're selling to SMBs, then you know you should be. If they have a lot of churn, that's fine. But at the same time, like their S&M costs need to be pretty low as well, right? They shouldn't be doing a bunch on sales and marketing because of the fact that they should have some sort of efficient go-to-market engine that's allowing these SMBs to come on board, and then also, you know, correspondingly leads to high churn, and that's okay, right? That still works with that model. But people aren't discerning that enough. Like they're looking at it and they're like, well, this company's moving up market, and so that's why they're spending more on sales and marketing. And while that is true, then the question needs to be, okay, well, how are you seeing the adoption in the enterprise market? Have you been able to segment the enterprise versus the SMB? Have you looked at the unit economics of both those different areas, right? And I don't think, at least from my opinion, like no analysis that I've read from these blog posts of people out there is doing that analysis, right? So that kind of worries me a bit.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. When I first looked at Shopify, which I never bought, including in December of 2018, thank you very much. I remember there. I was looking at the churn, and I was like, "Well, that makes a lot of sense because they're starting like there's you want churn in that, right? Because you get shots on goal, and then the way that they charge as you start moving more volume through, like it was very interesting. How aligned their entire business is with onboarding new businesses, and then how they tax. I think they tax volume going up in a very rational way. You can tell that it's like a platform that's there to help people really. It's clear that there's aligned incentives.
Yeah. I mean, they're a fascinating company, right? Because I think they've taken all the learnings that, you know, Salesforce has given the industry over the years, internalized those, and then combined like best of breed of a efficient product led go to market engine and product model with also this like sort of top down engine as well. It's really a fascinating company because not many have been able to pull that off in the way that Shopify has. And that's why, like, you know, I always joke, like people talk about, like, you know, Charlie Munger says that Lollapalooza of confluence of events and all that sort of thing. For me, that is Shopify. Like, they are taking learnings from all these different things. Like, you even think about the act two that they realized to expand their enterprise value, which was, hey, right now we have software subscriptions. Those are going really well. You know what? One thing we could do, though, is we could offer payments on the platform, and that will actually provide a better experience. But in the meantime, hey, we also get, you know, some nice economics off of that as well, right? That is such an interesting way of thinking, and that requires you to be thinking about, well, how am I going to add value to the customer, which is bundling in payments so that they don't have to go to another provider, it's fully integrated and all that sort of stuff. But then the payoff for that is you also make some money off that, even if like your implicit margin on that may be lower than, you know, what is being stated by the subscription revenue, right? And that to me is like just very interesting thinking. So that's why, you know, I think I joke that people always ask me like, what's the best way to learn about enterprise software? I'm just like, go and read, I'm forgetting the book now, but the Benioff has a book that he wrote about Salesforce. Like, you go and read that book, and then you go and read Salesforce's you know, transcriptions. You go in and talk to you know, SIs, like consulting firms, you talk to customers, just go and do that research. And what you'll learn is like this fascinating thing about how distribution works in software, how they were able to get their, you know, not great software out there and have everybody using it and continue to use it. And what Shopify is going to be is like that next version of Salesforce. Like, the what I'm so excited about is the investors that are growing up now, and they're all excited about these SaaS stocks and stuff like that. They're going to be studying Shopify to learn from, and their understanding of business is going to be so much greater than ours, because we started off with Oracle, right? Or we started off with, you know, something else, right? And that's going to be really interesting.
Yeah. In your perception, I mean, Shopify would be a much more product-led growth, right, though, rather than distribution. Is that an accurate statement?
Not quite. Like, they
really?
Yeah, they actually have like a bunch of different models in there that have sort of different engines. Because what happens with product-led growth is normally you have this mass adoption of things, and then you use that mass adoption to then, you know, start what's called like an inside sales engine, which is basically just like you have a bunch of usage. And so you can see like, hey, I have a lot of Coca-Cola developers using this. Let me go and talk to Coca-Cola CTO or VP of engineering or whatever. Be like, hey, listen, you already got a bunch of people paying me. Let's do an enterprise-wide contract. You'll get, you know, enterprise features as well and security and all these things. You'll get integrations, and it'll benefit you in a big way, right? And that's sort of the classic product-led growth. How do you harvest that those leads to then do it? What Shopify is doing, though, is notice how, like, you know, they just had, I think, Heinz Ketchup or something like that. They've had some pretty large brands like Pepsi and stuff going and selling through Shopify. Now, that, I can tell you, is not a bottoms-up product-led sale, yeah, right? That is a relationship person going in saying, hey, listen, I know you got a new brand you're trying to spin up. I know you're looking at Adobe's Magento. I know you're looking at BigCommerce, you know, all this sort of things. Here's the reason why you should go with Shopify, because we integrate with this. We're building out logistics. We can help you in these ways, right? That is a very relationship driven sale. And that's what's so fascinating about Shopify is the fact that that organization can do both and maintain that at such a high rate and high velocity is all about like organization of people, right? And you know, one of the things that's most fascinating to me about business in general is in the end, it all comes down to people, right? Whether the people that you invest in or these managers and how they organize these constructs. And so, you know, I always go back to, is it centralized decision making or is it decentralized? And for me, what I'm looking for is like Buffett centralizes certain decisions, right? If it's a big capital allocation decision, he is going to make that decision. It's going to be centralized between him and Munger. Everything else, decentralized, right? And that allows them to move more quickly than others in making deals and things like that. You know, Mark Leonard, the opposite, right? Like, I mean, he centralizes obviously certain core decisions as, you know, are we going to spin this off? Like, you know, what should we do from a high up, you know, return hurdle expectation or things like that. But in the meantime, Constellation Software is highly, highly decentralized, right? Because the goal is that any one portfolio manager, or I forget what they call the I think business unit leaders or whatever, can go and do a $10 million, maybe $5 million acquisition as long as it hits the hurdle rate, right? That is so powerful, but that is org design. That has nothing to do with software. That has nothing to do with, you know, it's just, it's all org design, right? And so that's where I get really fascinated. Is like, you can go and study org design your whole life, still not understand it. But if you can evaluate these, you can start to understand competitive advantages a lot better, where it's like, okay, I now understand how decision-making is done. I understand why it's done in that way. And then I can understand how that will lead to better capital allocation decisions in the future.
Yeah, that makes sense. I may not have been precise enough. I guess I was thinking more of like, I have a buddy that works at Accenture, right? And I think of like that as distribution led rather than product led, because I know how some of the companies come into like the Accenture sales force, right? And it's like, we are going to now do this implementation for our customers. So I guess that's what I more meant, like partnering. I was reading, I think it was A16Z wrote about Bill.com. And again, because of Not Boring, he wrote a pretty scathing review of that product. It was pretty funny. He's like, let's kill this product before it becomes part of my life, because I really don't want that to happen.
That's I love that about, like, we all use such terrible software, right? But, like, it's so hard to start a new habit, right? It's so hard to learn something new. I was on... I don't know if you ever use this app, but it's called Wunderlist. Have you ever?
I don't know.
So basically, it was a to-do app, right? So you would go in, you put your tasks, and then you could click them off. It's like a stupid, like, you know, little kind of thing, right? I don't know why it exists, really. But then when you start using it, you realize that this is the best thing ever, right? Like, yeah. It's all I use. And so the funny thing is like, even now I have a bunch of different software where I could put my to-dos and my tasks and lay it out all neatly and stuff. But I still use Wunderlist because it is the easiest thing in my mind. Whenever I think, hey, I have a task, there's zero friction in just going immediately. I know where to click on my phone or where to click on my desktop, put it open. I know how the UI works. I can type it in really quick, press enter, boom. That task is now logged, right? Yeah. And because I understand that hierarchy and how that works, I'm never going to switch. Like, that's nobody. If you try and give me Notion, which I use, I'm still not going to use it for my tasks, because the easiest way to do it is to use Wunderlist.
What do you like about Notion?
You know, Notion's just so flexible.
Because you recommended it, right? When I asked about Rome versus Notion or whatever. Isn't that?
Yeah. Well, I recommended actually you to try out something called Lazy Software.
No, I'm sorry.
Which you should actually check out at some point. Okay. But I think you're also looking at Rome and you're looking at Notion. They, I would say they all have different use cases. So Rome, I use much more for, you know, the key that Rome brought to bear was like, hey, there's this graph of your knowledge base. If you could create that graph, there's pretty interesting thing that could happen, right? You could start linking concepts like, for example, distribution. You could link, you know, Shopify to Kroger's, because you're looking at distribution as a concept, right? And that's really cool. What Notion did, though, was like, hey, we can make a really flexible, easy to use database for any of us to use, right? So we use it for our investment pipeline, which has like qualification criteria and you know, things like that. We use it as a database for all of our board meetings and, you know, updates and calls like that. We also use it just to take notes on a random company, right? And the fact that it's that flexible and you can have all these different tables and, you know, you can nest videos in there and you can do all these different things, makes it just a really powerful database for, you know, an everyday consumer to use.
Remember when we all had to save a Word document and then circulate it, and then people had different tasks and had to say, yes, I did this? I mean, it's crazy. Kids listen to this are going to be like, you guys are...
You know, Word is going to be so interesting for like the young kids coming up too, because I think right now I think most of them are getting used to Google Docs.
Yeah.
Which is natively collaborative, right? And so, like, just imagine if we had grown up using something where it's like, hey, Shomik's typing this, and all of a sudden Bill's in the same document and is, like, you know, editing stuff or highlighting something in there or whatever. Like, if that's from day one how you're taught, you know, word processing is supposed to go, I don't, like, that probably has, like, a bunch of different changes in how you work in the future and how you think about collaboration and stuff like that, right? Like, that's so cool to me. I don't know what that will look like, obviously, but, like, I'm just waiting for, you know, the one-year-olds or whatever, five-year-olds or whatever age they are, to get to, you know, when they're 20 and see how they're working.
I'll tell you what has blown my mind. It's not related, but it has blown my mind is this Oculus. Have you messed around with one of these?
I have.
Dude, that is the future. Like, I put that thing on, I was like, this is crazy.
It's one of the most realistic things, right?
Yeah. There was a flyover, right, of some island. And I was looking down, and the only thing that I could, like, kind of nitpick was there was a place where the waves were crashing under the trees, and, like, I could see that, right? Once they fixed that, I mean, kids, I was telling my father-in-law, I said, I just think that it's inevitable that these are going to be in every classroom. And when you're doing marine biology, it doesn't have to be an Oculus, but something that, like this. When you're studying marine biology, you're just going to go down and swim with manta rays, right? Like, why would you not? Why, you want to see what the fish look like? Let's just go scuba diving. It's crazy.
You know what's funny is I wish, and I do hope that this will change. I don't know if you remember this thing called Google Glass.
I do, and it flopped pretty badly.
It flopped really badly. And then Snap came out with spectacles.
Those I did not see.
Okay, so Snap came out with spectacles, and basically what those were was it could just record, like, 10-second videos from your glasses. So, like, if you were doing – actually, it would be great if they rolled it out now for, like, TikTok use cases, it would probably take off because all the kids would be filming, you know, for TikTok. But what's really interesting to me is, like, I don't know why AR hasn't taken off in a bigger way than it currently has. Like, VR I can see the use cases, right? Like, obviously, for a fully immersive experience, it's amazing, right? You put on the Oculus. I played some Star Wars game. Darth Vader was in front of me. I was using the Force to throw things around. I was like, this is the coolest thing ever, right? Yeah. Meanwhile, like, all your friends are looking at you like, I know what he's doing, but he also still looks ridiculous, right? But, like, AR has so many use cases, right? Because for AR, I imagine, like, what I want to have happen, this is actually what I truly want to get to, is you know, I haven't attended a trade school, but it's actually, like, something I would love to do is, like, one day learn how to, you know, do plumbing, for example, or something like that, right? I still don't understand how no one's come up with, you know, consumer AR glasses that helps you with here's how to actually, you know, fix the toilet, or here's how to, you know, fix the drain or whatever, right? Like, that is a step-by-step thing. Obviously, there's going to be nuances to it, but I'm sure there's, like, generalities that you could at least bring to bear. And that seems like an awesome way to teach, you know, me and you, like, everyday jobs that, you know, I at least don't know anything about, right? And that's where I want to get to. But, like, the Oculus is not going to do that. What we need is, like, more of, like, the Google Glass or spectacles. But they can't be these, like, we're trying to change the world and do all these things. Like, it's just, like, find this use case and go nail that use case, right? Like, why are you trying to, like, you know, help me see Batman on buildings? Like, I don't care. I just want to be able to fix my plumbing.
Yeah, basically have a YouTube that's right in front of your eye, but that you can also, like, see through, so that when you're doing the task, you can, like, watch the video as you're doing the task. But to your point, like, with Oculus, you're so, I mean, you've entered a different world. I think they have that for, I thought that I read that they had that for elevator training where they were sending, but I think it's, again, I think it's like an immersive headset that you watch the, I guess, the thing being fixed in front of you, and then you go out and do it. But I think it's inevitable. I don't know how far we are, but, you know, on the long time frame of how far we've come over the last 10 years to where we're going, I don't see how it doesn't end up there.
Yeah, I mean, Microsoft HoloLens is probably the furthest along in that area, where there's actually, like, people who are doing surgery. They'll actually put on a HoloLens, and you can walk through, like, a mock surgery. but that's, again, augmented reality. That's not necessarily VR where it's fully immersive. I think you could probably do it also in VR and have a good experience, but I think there's something to be said for, like, walking through, like, you know, surgery on a cadaver and still having to feel everything for real, but being able to at least see that overlay of what you're supposed to do through AR. So that's what gets me excited there.
Are you naturally into tech?
I grew up in Jersey. I went to school in Pittsburgh. For me, actually, the height of my career was, I got an investment banking job, and like, that's what I thought you were supposed to do. Like, you were supposed to go and become an investment banker. Right. So tech was like the furthest thing from my mind. Right. What started was actually more of getting into investing. And I just started seeing these business models and being like, huh, those are interesting business models. Like, I should learn about them. Right. And that started to get me into the business model as a whole. And from there, I got really interested in tech. So now, one of the most impressive firms to me is Lux Capital. You know, at Boltstar, we only focus on enterprise software, and hopefully we continue to be good at that. But Lux Capital is like investing in mind-brain connection devices, and then also investing in like space rockets and like, you know, stuff like that. And to have that range to be able to go across like biotech and hard tech and, you know, whatever is just so fascinating to me. So I love reading their stuff. I love watching their videos, right? Unfortunately, I'm very much a enterprise software guy, and that will be where I'll stay. But I think those sort of things are just so cool to read about.
Do you in your specialty, how long did it take you to ramp up understanding like the actual technical aspects of the product that you're, like, you guys are seed, right? So you're backing the founder. How much are you monitoring as this founder builds out their product, like the actual technical aspects of it versus just consumer adoption and talking to the consumers and figuring that out? Because one thing that I've tried to figure out is like, I can look on the 10Ks, I can watch the KPIs, but like, I never feel like I really know what's going on with the software and where the threats are.
Yeah. I mean, So none of us are like expert programmers or developers or anything like that, right? We've all programmed something at one time or another, but like, you know, I did Tetris in college, and like, I forget, you know.
Tetris is awesome.
Yeah, it was great, but like, I forget how to do it, right? Like, I'd have to go back and reread my notes and figure it out. One of the things though is you know, I think when you're focused on an area, and this is why we like being specialists actually, is because we, you know, Boltstar only does seed stage enterprise software. We don't even do Series A's. Like, we are literally, you know, we like to be the first check in our companies, right? Which is partnering them from when they're at the pre-product stage with just an idea. They now got to go build out that product, and they got to build out the business. And that's where we want to help them, right? And so when you think about that stage, what's really interesting is mostly, one, it's a people bet. So you got to understand, like, what does this person know? Like, what's their secret, or what's their hidden knowledge that nobody else knows, which makes them the right person to tackle this area, right? And then the other thing goes into, okay, well, now do they understand the competition and how the competition is thinking, what moves they would be naturally making? Again, if we're talking about moving into product adjacencies, the interesting thing about the competitive landscape is, while right now you could say like, okay, here's how I am differentiated from all these other companies, they are also dynamic beasts, right? And they're also trying to figure out where they're going to move next. And so you almost need to have an idea of, you know, hey, I've actually used that software before, and I've also used their software before, and I know where their weaknesses are, and also where their product leanings are going based on using it. And so because of that, I think here's an area that they're not focused on and won't focus for a while. And that's why I'm going to go build in that area. Right. So that's what we're trying to understand, is like, how far down the idea maze has this person thought about this, lived the pain, and figured it out. Right. And then when it actually goes to building out the software, you know, I would say we've now read enough engineering blogs and worked with enough companies and things like that, that we can kind of get a general sense of like the trade-off decisions that they're making. And again, we don't actually need to read the code to understand what's happening. What we can, though, is understand is if they say, you know, here's a programming language choice that we made, right? Well, we can say, okay, well, based on that, you're going to have these issues potentially in the future from a technical debt perspective, right? Are you prepared for those? Or if they're like, hey, we're favoring this, we're going to be like, okay, that's going to ramp up speed, but that's going to slow down these other, you know, that's going to make it harder for you to do this other component, right? And if that's the case, then we need to be mindful and watch that. So that's the level that we're watching, is like kind of just trying to understand those trade-offs, trying to evaluate them, and then help the founders either one, teach us why that's the right way, or talk with them about, hey, here's another way to think about it and why we think that you should approach it from this way, right? So we don't necessarily need to be able to see the code. We just need to be able to understand those trade-offs.
That's got to be super rewarding when it works out, right? Because it's like a true partnership from the jump.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it is. It's there's a bunch of highs and lows, I would say.
I'm sure. You know, it's like a marriage. There's obviously my marriage has no lows, but just saying.
Exactly. Yeah.
The theoretical marriage. Yeah,
exactly. But no, it's got its highs and lows. I would say the highs are really high and the lows are really low. And the crazy thing about being a venture investor is you have a portfolio of companies, right? So if something doesn't work out, you still have other companies that are probably, you know, doing well. For that one founder, though, or for the co-founders, or for that team, that is, you know, what they've dedicated their lives to. That's the trade-offs that they've been making in some cases, is not spending as much time with their kids, you know, all sorts of things. And to have that be a failure is a lot, right? It's a huge emotional burden. It's and it's just devastating. So those are the sort of things that I think make the job, I think, just very interesting, because it's not just a pure business model or technical evaluation or anything like that. Like, these are people, you need to be talking with them every day. You need to be understanding how they're feeling. You need to be helping them out when they're feeling bad and down, and trying to actually uplift their spirits, right? Or sympathizing with them when something's going wrong, because, you know, they're humans just like us, right? And we sometimes glorify these founders, but like, you know, I'm sure Toby at Shopify still has really terrible days, right? And it's funny, because we always just think about like, how are they going to compound or stuff? But, you know, if he has a mental breakdown, like, maybe that actually has significant damages the enterprise value or something, right? Because of his knowledge and the way he leads the organization. So those are all things that I kind of, you know, think about as we're talking with companies.
Yeah, I started a flooring franchise in 2009, which was a really dumb decision, and I wasn't the right person to do it. So the confluence of those factors created a fair amount of, I wasn't like depressed in a clinical way, but I had a long time that I did not believe in myself. And it took I would say it probably took like 3 or 4 years to get over that failure. That was by far the worst thing that I've ever gone through on a professional level, because to just like, I was too disorganized and I didn't know what the hell I was doing. I don't know why I thought I was the right person for that at that time. But, you know, the other part of it was really hard to separate how much was the economic drop, you know, backdrop, how much was my franchisor dropping the ball, which I do think they did, how much of it was me, which I know I did. But it, you know, when putting that much effort into something, sleeping at the office and trying to get it off the ground and just like not getting there, that sucked. And if you believe in somebody and you're there and you're coaching them up and it just doesn't take off, that's got to be hard to watch.
Can I ask you a question on that? So if you went back to your 2009 self and you were starting this business all over again, did you have a co-founder at that time?
Or I had a partner.
You're a partner? Okay.
Yeah.
Would you have?
You're probably not the best partner.
Got it. Okay. Would you have, chose the people that you worked with though differently or augmented yourself in some way? Because I find like sometimes a lot of those is because you're taking too much of the burden on yourself. And when you realize that, hey, if I hired somebody else, like that actually could have augmented the whole business. It's kind of interesting. Yes. To do a postmortem on that.
Yeah. So when I said not the best partner, I mean, I love this guy. Like, thankfully, it's the one thing that it didn't cost me was my relationship with him, because he's the closest thing to a brother I have. There's like three of us. But the problem with that setup that we had was none of us had the technical chops or the industry expertise to really know. Like in 2009, it was about really knowing where you could get the best stuff to source. It was about really knowing what your install costs were going to be. It was not about like this fluffy sales process that you think you can get through, which I don't think business is ever not about. Like you always have to know the nuts and bolts. But I think that we relied on the franchisor more than we should have to provide that expertise. And I think I'm outside of the period where I can't say anything about them. So I would argue that they oversold their capability to deliver that. And they also undersold how expensive it would be to get the help. And I should have diligenced better. Like one thing that I really screwed up was, you know, they have like the model, right? And this is the capital that you're going to need and whatever. Well, that model may work in, you know, Kansas City or whatever. You need a lot more capital in Chicago or Chicagoland than you do in Kansas City. Mm-hmm. And maybe, you know, a zip code that you're blanketing with mailers in Kansas City can work and you can hit that same zip code for this amount of dollars. But in Chicagoland, there's so many more houses that like your spend is really spread out. And I feel like if I could go back and do it again, I would say, don't go do it again. But if I had to, I would really, really drill down on like one specific area and I would hire somebody that had a lot of technical expertise.
All right. In Bill, flooring. You have a VC career ahead of you. That is literally like, that is the advice that, pretty much universally is the hardest thing to figure out, but also like the simplest concept to kind of understand, but the hardest thing to truly grok, right? Is like, yeah. Because of even just what you mentioned of like, hey, if I only focused on Kansas, one, I would have understand that, you know, I could understand the competitive landscape of the Kansas other floors very well and how I could differentiate. And then two, also, I could solve a specific pain point. Maybe I would, you know, I know all Kansas houses have rugs on the first floor and they all want hardwood, right? So I'll only do hardwood and I'll only do it in these two colors. So then I know the supply that I'm getting, I can source more easily. I can push more volumes through them to decrease my costs, right? Like there's all these sort of compounding decisions that happen from that narrowing of your initial scope. Right. Yeah. And that happens in software, that happens in, you know, I mean, you name it, any business, right? When you're starting out, you need to have that one solution and understand that pain point very well, understand the market landscape, understand everything about this area. And if you can do that, you can have a really successful business over time. But we always have the tendency to want to go bigger, right? Because the dollars with that niche are probably, frankly, very small as well, right? And so that's the hard part to always think about.
Yeah, that's right. And we mentioned Oren. One thing that I had spoken to him about, and I don't think he'd mind me saying this, so I'm going to say it, is, you know, he's like, I built this successful company. And here on the West Coast, you know, there's this feeling of like, well, why isn't it much bigger? And it's like, well, the answer is because we're really good at what we do, right? And maybe there aren't as many tangential markets to enter as quickly. But I know that when I'm selling my product to somebody, like, this is what is going to work. And I think that, you know, sometimes I guess that I will never poo-poo anybody that wants to dominate one niche in one area. And if they say, you know what, I'm just going to kill it in this line of business, and maybe it doesn't get so big that I'm, you know, the founder that everybody heralds, but I've built, you know, a business that can provide for my family. Like, that's awesome. And I think that we tried to, you know, it was the agreement with the franchisor too. Like, we were young and naive and we thought like, let's go big quick or strike out. And, you know, in retrospect, life worked out, but, if I were to do it over again, I'd do it a lot slower.
It's you know, one of the things we all say is like, go slow to go fast, right? And
yeah.
And then you got to go niche to go broad. And those are like all these things of just trying to slow down this complex adaptive system to something that you can understand and control before it starts to get out of hand, right? Because once it gets out of hand, the horse is out of the stable, right? It's going, right? And now you're just trying to, like, you know, catch it and go for the ride, right? And so those are all sorts of, you know, things that you have to consider. And I think the other interesting aspect to it too is you know, what I get really excited about, even talking with you, having gone through that experience, is I imagine that from 2009 to, you know, you said 5 years or something, so let's say 2013.
Well, it was 2011 when we folded, but it took me like 5 years to get over that failure.
Yeah, got it. Yeah. I mean, which makes complete sense. But even in that 2 years, right, like the things that you learn and especially as the business grows, the complexity that you have to handle also is this crazy thing to look back on yourself and be like, oh my God, I went from managing, you know, one person or maybe no people, right, to managing five people, 10 people, whatever that answer is. That requires just like a whole different skill set. And so that's why the crazy thing about, you know, some of these founders is one, their ability to kind of scale up with the organization. But then two, like I think sometimes we the CEO title gets like so much cachet around it, right? Like you're the CEO, like this is your baby and stuff like that. But you know, in reality, like it's all just dependent on skill set. So a certain CEO may be the right person just because you know, they've managed a complex organization before, and there's certain best practices to do that. And if a founder then moves to, you know, a COO role or some other role, that's completely fine, right? Because they're still doing what they enjoy. They're still adding the most value that they can at that time. And they don't want to be CEO. But that's in the venture industry, that sometimes is seen as a, you know, as a loss or as, hey, this founder didn't live up to their potential. Instead, I'm like, that's an unselfish act of somebody who's like, I want to benefit the company as a whole. Right. Mm-hmm. And this is the best decision for the company perspective. And so for that reason, I'm willing to do this, or maybe I just enjoy doing this. Right. And I don't want to be the CEO. So I think those more, that needs to be normalized more, like even all this stigma around like talking through these trade-offs and talking through mental issues and all this sort of stuff. Like, it's crazy that we just don't have that in normal discourse. Right. Because it should be something that's more appreciated and that we're able to be better equipped to handle.
Yeah, I think this sort of aligns with, you can get all the credit if you don't mind who gets the credit, if that, or you can accomplish everything if you don't mind who gets the credit. Like, I'm working on trying to put together a pretty cool episode on this, and I think a different host would be better. Like, and there's a certain amount of me that doesn't want to say, you know what, this guy would be better for this interview, but that's who I want to do the interview, right? Like, I want the best interview on this show that I can get. So why would I not pull that person in? And the only answer is ego, but like, screw that, you know, I'd rather produce something dope. So, you know, it's different, right? But I think that the capability of saying, and when I was younger, I wanted to be the guy that, you know, I run this and whatever. I wasn't in the right place to. I wasn't mature enough, and I shouldn't have been. Not that I had skills, right? But I tried to take on way too much.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, that it's a blend, though. You want that ambition, but you also want – it's always the joke of, like, you wish you had your learnings when you're 80 for right now, right?
Yeah,
that's right. You'd be a lot more successful, but, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah, indeed. How do you like, identify the founder that's not only got these qualities, but also hungry enough? You know, that's got to be sort of tough, because I would think you want somebody that's had some success, but also still has a lot of fire in them.
Yeah, I mean, success is not necessarily a prerequisite, because in fact, it, in some cases, actually failure might be actually more important, right? Because it drives that individual or those individuals to want to accomplish more and also a bunch of hard fought learnings, right? So again, I think from the founder standpoint, there's no one like archetype that fits, right? Because for each product, for each industry, different things may succeed, right? I would say what they all though have in common is this ability to really understand deeply the customer's workflow, right? And either one, it's because they've been in their shoes and they've actually done the job that whatever they're building is doing. Or the flip side of it is just they have this, you know, innate ability to be able to understand things by just talking with others and synthesizing that and getting a framework for it, right? But that's kind of the key thing. If you can find someone who understands that, what happens is their learning velocity is so quick that even as a competitor makes a certain market move or rolls out a new product or whatever, that person's already kind of thought about, well, what would happen there? Or because it's happened before, maybe they've read about, you know, how that's worked in the past with other products or something like that. And they can be like, you know what? Actually, let me go back and reread, you know, something I read for a while, or let me go back and talk to this person, right? And they'll start to synthesize those learnings and be like, I think we can do this, right? I think we can flank in this way, or I think we can pivot to this, right? And all of a sudden, the business keeps on going without a stutter, right? So a lot of what we're looking for is, you know, do they have an innate passion for what they're building? Do they have that ability to understand the workflow and how that end user is going to be using their product, right? And I would say this goes not just for software, but like even like, you know, paint or flooring or things like that, right? You still need to understand like what is, like what's the thickness somebody want, what's the color they want, what's the consistency, all these different things, right? And so those things are what we're looking for. And I think, you know, one of my favorite things to do is go back and reread The Idea Maze. So it's this guy, Balaji Srinivasan, who was a general partner at Andreessen Horowitz. I think he was the CTO of Coinbase for a while. He's also, you know, been a founder of multiple different other companies. But he taught this class, and there's a whole lecture on it called The Idea Maze. And what it talks about is this journey of walking through all the different components of an idea. And when you find people who have done that, that makes amazing founders, because they've been thinking about for, you know, whatever, the duration doesn't matter, but they've been thinking about it so deeply such that they understand all these different components and inputs to the journey. And when you've already done that, then you're able to start to take little feedback or kinks in the plan and adjust them quickly, because you've already been thinking through like all these different dynamics over time.
That's interesting. You know, I just have one thought, and I have been listening to you, but the one thought that I had that just going back, like what I did wrong, I wish that I hadn't underpriced myself. You know, every deal that I didn't land, I would default to price, right? And it's like, then I'd be like, oh, well, now I have to cut a corner here, cut a corner there to get my margin. And it's like, sometimes just saying, this is what I'm delivering and this is what it costs me to do it. You either want it or you don't, right? Like, but if you hire me, you're going to get the right product. That would have been a healthier, like selling from a position of strength would have helped. I was a mouse on the idea maze in that particular entity. I was running through the maze. I had not thought it through.
we're all mice at some point of the idea maze. But yeah. But what you brought up is an interesting concept. You know, I was talking with the founder the other day, and what we were talking about was, hey, you know, I've got this contract with a large, you know, great logo, enterprise, Fortune 500, Fortune 100 company, right? It's going to be a logo that everybody would want to have on their list, right? But what's interesting is it was going to take a bunch of professional services. It was going to take a lot of time to stand up. And frankly, they would have to devote a ton of resources to it as well. So the hidden cost with something like that is you go from saying, okay, well, notionally, this is a great logo. They're paying me a bunch of money. This is great. Like, I should be excited, right? The hidden cost, though, is the resources. Because you're spending so many resources on this one customer, you maybe stopped yourself from you know, innovating on the product to then serve five other customers, right? Mm-hmm. Which then are going to be more referrals to other customers and so on and so forth, right? And so those sort of trade-offs are so hard to identify in real time. But in some cases, like what you're saying is like, if the price isn't right, and that could, prices is not just dollar amounts, but also the resource and the time that you'd have to put behind it. If it isn't right, sometimes the best decision is, unfortunately, to walk away, right? And yeah. Say, hey, right now, this is not the best time for my business. I would love to, you know, get back in touch with you in a year or something when I have a bit more resources to tackle this. But right now, like, unless we're able to pay this much or something, like, it just doesn't make sense.
Yeah, that's right. I had a friend that I knew that signed a deal. He was developing a game type company, and he signed a deal with Disney and Mattel. And, you know, the day that the deal gets signed is the greatest deal ever, but then it's got to go into production, and all of a sudden he needs more people. and then the deal isn't going quite as well as he thought, and the working capital, you know, they're squeezing him on the terms. And like, now you got all these employees, right? And then it's like, well, how do I get this produced? And it ended up costing him a lot more stress. And I think if I asked him now, would you redo the deal? He'd say no way. But, you know, at the time, it made a lot of sense. And I probably would have said yes, too. I'm not trying to take a shot at him. But it's interesting how sometimes the things that appear the best are not exactly the best when you look back at it.
Have you invested in any like flooring companies since, or?
No, man, but I did get a pitch on the franchisor. They're Toronto listed, and I was just like, I can't do it.
You're like, I know too much.
That's right. I was like, I know this thing inside and out, and I don't even think it's a bad investment, but I'm gonna pass on that one. Thank you very much. I'm not trying to live on other people's tears. No, thank you.
That's amazing.
But I'll tell you what I have done is the concept of outsourcing, and I think from listening to you and other interviews, I think we see things somewhat similarly. Like with IAC, I own that. I almost view that as like my allocation to like venture tech, right? And it's like, I know that these guys do offline to online. They specialize in marketplaces. I'm probably never even going to look at this thing. But that's my allocation, right? And we'll see how it turns out. And I sort of judge that based on what they've done in the past. So we'll see. I mean, do you do that? I think you've done that, or at least talked about it. I don't want to misframe what you're saying, but with CSU and IAC, is that how you think of those?
Yeah. So IAC, exactly what you said. I would say I've studied a lot about marketplaces, right? And I think I understand some components of network effects to be able to evaluate them on my own. But that being said, like, I don't live in them every day, right? And so for me, you know, what's funny is a lot of people, I think, on FinTwit and you know, hedge funds in general, like, they go buy IAC, right? And then they go look through the components and they're like, oh, Angie's List is such a large part of the valuation. And then they go down a rabbit hole about Angie's List and blah, blah, this and that. And like, service providers and, you know, whatever. Like, it makes my mind spin, right? I don't even understand it, right? Fixed price model.
How's this different from Yelp? I don't know.
Yeah. But like, for me, all I can say is like, Joey Levine and Barry Diller and, you know, all the stuff that they've done in marketplaces over the years. I mean, from everything from Expedia and Ticketmaster to, you know, Match and all these different marketplaces, right? If they see something in it, I can guarantee you it's not something that I'll be able to figure out. Like, there's just no way, right? So for something like that, and again, this goes back to, why, you know, I believe in specialization and why at Boltstart we believe it too. But personally, I've decided to specialize in enterprise software. The reason I do that is because I think the compounding knowledge that you get in that one vertical or that one area that you focus on, gives you a competitive advantage compared to others, right? And there's different ways to attack it. So it's not to say, like, you know, there's tons of generalist investors that are, you know, have invested in Shopify and then have also invested in, you know, American Tower and Facebook, right? Like, and they're able to do that and they're able to go across and do all those things. But for me, I'd rather put my money with the specialist who understands that area so well that I don't even need to worry about. Like, if Angie doesn't work out, they have many other marketplaces that are going to work out. They're going to invest in the new ones, and at least that will be the way to go about it. But again, though, what's interesting is think through what's centralized and decentralized in all these different companies that we mentioned, right? And with IAC, again, it's one of these things where it's centralized in terms of like large capital allocation. But then they're still buying these companies that have their own owners that they are also looking at. Are they owner operators? Are they going to do what's best for the long term of the business? And if they don't, IAC will step in, replace the CEO, right, and put those incentives aligned such that that is the proper way to do things. So a lot of this is tied more to culture and to people and to decision making than it is to economics, which is kind of hearsay when we're talking about, right? But like, IAC can compound for a very long time because of the knowledge that they've grown, so that like the next marketplace that they found, they're going to be able to shorten the time frame for that to go from 0 to 100 a lot more than what they were able to do 10 years ago, right? And so how much could the value compound in the future? Like, I don't know, but I think a lot.
Yeah. How do you think through, like, some people have said to me, well, the Vimeo thing is sort of like Wall Street. And I said, yeah, but the other side of that is, like, they have a really unique asset right now. And I do understand saying that we should spin this off and let our people get compensated based on how this business performs. And by the way, like, stock comp, if you're not playing the game that everyone else is playing, it seems to me that you're at, like, an unnecessary disadvantage. So, I mean, are you, like, as a shareholder, do you get excited at the prospect of, like, how do you analyze, I guess, the Vimeo transaction?
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. So, you know, Vimeo is something that I think is pretty exciting. What's happening right now is you see this whole creator economy that's happening. I mean, I think you are a great part of it, right? With this podcast and what you're doing around this is you're honestly creating this sphere of influence by doing what you're doing really well. I don't know how that will accrue to you, but it's going to accrue to you. In some-
Nor do I. It's all just a donation.
but the cool thing is like we said, right? It's bringing interesting people to your network. And at the edge of their network is going to be somebody that's super interesting that's going to help you with something. Like, I guarantee you, at some point that's going to happen, right? And so the interesting thing with Vimeo is it's empowering all these creators to be able to easily get their video content out there, right? And as latencies have reduced, and with WebRTC and all these different things that are happening in the technological landscape, right? It empowers videos to be more prevalent in all the things that we look at on a daily basis. And so because of that, if you can now bring in awesome editing software that also has distribution, by the way, baked into that as well, the tail of that is pretty long, because I can think of all different ways. Like, Vimeo probably could have a separate business unit inside of it, only focused on what are those stories, you know, Facebook stories and Instagram stories and things like that, right? These sort of different way of making this video. It's a different format. It's a different audience that you're going. And if they just specialize in that, they could probably go pretty far. So that's kind of what excites me about their ability to compound way out in the future. They're moving up enterprise, but they still have this, you know, product-led growth area where individual creators can go pay Vimeo for, I think, $30 a month or something like that, and then have this tool set at their disposal to be able to create, you know, wonderful experiences. So I think that's what kind of broadly gets me really excited about it. But, you know, one thing I'll say is, so you mentioned stock comp, and anyway, I'm going to go on a little bit of a rant here.
But, okay, but please, like, do.
Because
I'm adult.
Well,
like, not adult, like adult.
Well, here's the thing. Okay, so I just, you know, everyone with all of these companies, right? Like, I understand how if you're at Coca-Cola and you're worried about stock comp, I can understand that, right? Because, you know, unless you have meaningful levers to expand the margin and the free cash flow that business is generating, you're diluting that stream, right? With stock comp. So I can understand focusing on that there. I mean, people look at, like, at Salesforce or Workday or, like, these companies are just like, stock comp's like up out the wazoo and everyone's getting paid in stock and, you know, what the heck? And, you know, we got to bake this into our valuations and stuff. And it's like, I mean, the only way this business works is through human capital. That is the most important thing. So, like, guess what? If your stock comp is you get to get, you know, Salesforce got Brett Taylor, who used to be the CTO at Facebook, created Google, or, you know, not him alone created Google Maps, but, you know, obviously led the Google Maps effort and is now, I think he's either CTO or COO at Salesforce. Like, how much is he worth? I don't know. Like,
a lot.
Can you put a value on the stock comp that Brett Taylor should be getting? You know, that he bought and Benioff did, right? He bought Quip for $750 million, and that basically got Brett Taylor over, right? But these are the kind of things where I just hate this focus that FinTwit has on what they can understand, right? What's easily understandable is, okay, stock comp is X amount. So if we back this out or whatever, here's what it looks like. And oh my God, this is egregious, right? Instead,
I'm guilty of this, by the way. You're speaking directly to me.
but I think instead it's trying to understand, well, what is the incentive for that stock-based comp, for that high stock-based comp, okay? And why is that incentive needed? Now, I would argue in something like Workday, I actually do think their stock-based comp is too high because of the fact that I think like in payroll software and where they're playing, like I don't fully grok why they need to be paying people that much in stock, right? Salesforce is the opposite. In fact, if you look at where Salesforce is right now, most of the stock comp is happening through these acquisitions, right? Which is natural, but they're expanding into large market adjacencies and creating their own bundle, which is pretty exciting for what they could do in the future. But if you actually talk to a Salesforce employee, they'll tell you, like, we're cash heavy, we're stock poor, right? And there's a reason that they do that, because Benioff and the team understands, you know, that at this point in certain areas of the business, stock comp is not really the main thing, right? You could get a brilliant engineer who's coming from India, pay them life-changing money in cash. They don't really care that much about stock comp, and you're still able to get the things done that you need to, right? And so I think that it's just that's just my rant. It's basically, I think there's too much of a focus on this. Instead we need to study the incentives behind it.
I guess that the thing that makes me nervous, and again, like this could just be me being stupid. I'm fully aware of that. But right now, with what I perceive to be the incentives to chase growth at almost all costs because of just how things are being rewarded generally in the market, I just sort of worry that as a minority shareholder that doesn't have any say in these businesses, that, you know, the answer today is to give stock comp. And then what happens when, you know, the growth slows or the business hits a hiccup and the stock drops is everybody's options are going to be rebased because you can't have everybody leave. So now I'm further diluted in a downside scenario. And then if I then am in a company that's got some problems, you know, they're competing against the other companies that are able to issue stock comp that is an attractive currency. So am I then having to even shower more stock comp on people because it is a people business and people can leave? Really good salespeople, you can't hire, right? Like they're worth their weight in gold. So they'll just leave. And I'm in other businesses, really good engineers, right? It depends on your go-to-market strategy. I guess that's what I fear. And what I guess that I'm really saying when I'm bitching about stock comp is that I need to work harder to figure out what I'm saying, right? I mean, it's probably just me being an idiot saying, I don't like stock comp and I should just do the work.
Well, I think there's value to both sides of it, right? Like any argument or anything like that, there's value to both sides. I think you're absolutely completely right. Like if the multiple goes down, right? Or if the business has a growth rate slow in a period of time that the market wasn't expecting, right? And the stock gets nailed. Well, first of all, one, like if you didn't rebase, like you said, people are going to leave, which is going to damage the enterprise value, or you diluted, you know, shareholders by rebasing those, right? That's definitely a risk. I don't know how often that's happened historically. I actually don't know. I don't know if you have a bunch of.
No, I don't have data for these opinions. Come on.
but you know, it's kind of interesting. Like I don't know like what happened let's say like Microsoft or something, like, you know, after the dot-com bubble would be really interesting actually to study from that perspective. But I keep going back to I think putting too much effort into looking at stock comp and trying to figure out how to back that out and, you know, all sorts of stuff like that is missing the forest for the trees. You know what I mean? Like you're missing the big opportunity and focusing too much on minute details, because those are things that we can understand and we can control in a way, right? Because we can say like, oh, this is how much they're diluting themselves. And, you know, if I keep that going, this is what free cash flow per share looks like in 10 years because of this dilution, right? What's the hard thing to consider though is what's that stock comp driving? And you know, some of that could be in tech, a lot of ways to uncover that is like you actually have to look at job board postings. And when you look at job board postings, you'll see like, you know, I don't know, Cloudflare is hiring a bunch of AWS serverless folks because they're working on their workers platform, right? Like that is something that could be paradigm shifting, could be, you know, next gen, like AWS type margins at steady state. If they're putting stock comp into that,
yeah, that's okay.
You should put more stock comp, right? Like you should be hiring the best people and going after that, because that opportunity is so big that's worth chasing. Now that takes a lot of diligence. That takes a lot of like kind of effort to go through these things. But you know, that's kind of where I get more excited, rather than, you know, I don't own Workday, by the way. And I do think their stock comp is egregious, like I said, because I'm not quite sure, but I haven't done the work. Like maybe they have something that they're doing on the payroll side or on the, you know, on the financial planning side or whatever that requires that much stock-based comp.
Yeah. Well, look, man, I am the first to admit that I have some mental things that I need to get over in myself. I mean, I have said over and over again, some of the advice that I think is the best advice is look in places that make no sense and things that are blindingly obvious. Adam Robinson said that. And like, I could easily say this makes no sense, why the stock comp is where it is and the valuations are where they are. Why don't I dig into this? But instead, you know, there's something about me that inherently worries about a market that is so looked at. And at least my perception of what's going on today is it just feels like people are saying like, oh, people are at home, buy Teladoc. And then it's like, they're, you know, oh, I'm a genius, I should start a fund. Like, no, let's, in 5 years, if you're still right, then we can talk about you starting a fund. Like, I don't know what the hell is going on right now. And I just, you know, it's the old, it's probably some self-defense mechanism. I don't know. Some psychologist can call me after this. But long story short, I just think that there's not enough diligence going on. And I probably irrationally attribute some of my fear to stock comp.
I mean,
it's probably stupid.
Well, I think to your point though, on the current behavior, I couldn't disagree with that. Like the fact I like I said, I see so many people like putting these, it's got to be 50% plus growth, and you know, it's got to be high margins and like blah blah this and that, and there's nothing mentioning about, you know, or maybe they do start going to competitive positioning and how the product actually fits in with end user workflows or anything. But most of those write ups that I read, there's no like secret sauce to, you know, or innate understanding of, well, here's how Datadog's monitoring product provides them a better entry point into application performance monitoring, which then provides them a better entry point into, you know, secure in the security market. Like that's the type of analysis that you need to be doing to understand companies at this valuation. Yeah. You understand like, hey, well, why, you know, it's not just, hey, New Relic is growing slow, and New Relic has an old product, so they suck. And so because of that, like, you know, we own Datadog because New Relic sucks, right? Like that's the type of analysis that I'm hearing now versus people saying like, hey, you know, maybe if you start in, you know, logs and you're ingesting these logs and you're taking information from them, that can then lead to a much better entry point into security, because when you're ingesting those logs, you're also seeing all these different events that are happening and all the breaches and, you know, all the little anomalies, right? And so for that reason, this is a better entry point, right? Like that analysis isn't happening. And that's scary to me, where that you have too many of these folks who are, you know, not to bring up Robinhood and talk about them, but like, you know, it is one of those things, right? I think they are creating this industry where a lot of folks are just, they're going by these simplistic methods, and it's worked in this environment, and maybe it will continue to work for the next 50 years, maybe, right? But I think it could also not, and it could also not
maybe,
work.
Maybe 2 years. I don't know about 50. We're gonna get to some crazy places if it's 50, man. I'll sell everything.
But I mean that does scare me, honestly. And it's not. I think luckily, you know, most of the founders are so paranoid about their business and so focused on what they're doing that they're not really as focused on like, oh, this company got this valuation, we need to beat them, and you know, blah blah this and that. They're just like, hey, what's the market now? We want to get a fair price compared to the market right now. And if we can get that, like, let's go to work, right? They're focused on actually building their business. But I think the investor mentality now is frankly a little bit, over exuberant, right? Like these EV SPACs that are going every single day. Like, the craziest thing to me was Microsoft announced a partnership with Datadog that had already actually been announced at like a previous conference, but they put out a formal press release. Datadog's stock that day went up something like 15 or 20%.
Yeah.
Like that was like $10 billion worth of market cap added because of a freaking press release that like was already known.
Yeah.
That is scary, right? That is really scary.
It's like when Peloton bought that company and solved like the manufacturing kink. It's like, guys, it's already like $49 billion on a diluted basis. You're telling me that the solving your manufacturing kink hasn't been like embedded in this price? You know, now I actually think that I've pivoted a lot on that name, and I can see much better how, you know, I used to think it was nonsense. Now I think, you know, it's got a shot, and I could see, you know, that the gym that I am a member at here actually uses the brand that they bought. So maybe that is the entrance into gyms, and like I can get my galaxy brain going on it. But I just feel like there's a lot of galaxy brain going around and not a lot of let's be measured about how all this is going to work and, you know, timing it out. But, you know, whatever. I just try to stick to stuff I know.
You know, with Peloton, what's really interesting to me is so if you think about more like a Costco type model where you're like, OK, what's the main driver? The main driver is the subscription revenue, right? So what drives subscription revenue over time? One of the interesting things to me is like, okay, well, you're doing the bike. That's great. But now they just put a bunch of money in and went into the treadmill area. Well, one, what does attach rates look like for that? I got to imagine not that much because they're both expensive devices, but maybe they're pretty high, which would be a bullish indicator. Or two, what's the net new subscribers that they're picking up from the treadmill entry point rather than the bike entry point, right? And the problem is like you have to scoop that data up from like a random conference call and then like, you know, somebody's mom talking about it on the phone and like, you know what I mean? And then like, yeah, that's how you're going to figure that out. But that's the bet that's like, honestly, a thing that I would be trying to understand with Peloton to get the valuation right now is what's that sub growth going to be looking like? And the only drivers I can think to that are like, well, is the entry point of them now bundling in yoga going to provide new subs or things like that? How do you prove that out? How do you get proof points on that? Again, you know, for now, people aren't worried about it, so what do we know, right?
Well, I'll tell you, like, this is totally anecdotal, and it could be just totally cherry-picked in my head. This could be nonsense that I'm about to say. But since they started to talk about how many workouts per person they do, or since I've seen that discussed in the investment community, I have felt as though there have been a lot of, like, you should do my warm-up class. Make sure to take my cool-down class. You know, like, in the beginning and the end. And it's become a very prominent thing that I should go back and do some of the earlier rides, because if you do a warm up, you bike and you cool down, that's three classes. That's not three sessions. That's one session.
Right.
So it's kind of Wells Fargo-y. I mean, I hate saying it, but it is. Now, I don't think it's a Wells Fargo product. I think it's a great product. And where I think the Bulls could have a lot of merit in what they're talking about is, you know, if you use the app a lot and you use it to meditate and you use it to do yoga, it is a pretty good value proposition. Yep. I mean, you're really only paying like $1 a day, maybe a little bit more, but, and then you got to amortize the cost of the bike, but still, long story short, it's a lot cheaper than personal training.
Yeah. But what we're again looking at with all these sort of businesses is at these, I think the main point that I would make is at these high valuations, the analysis changed from do we understand what the product is doing and how that's working to how are they expanding into adjacencies, right? Because that's the core bet. In order to make these things work, you need to understand how they're moving into adjacencies. And so that's why, like, the Twilio acquisition of Segment to me was like mind blowing. Like, that was, I'm really excited about what they could do there. I think I've been really excited about, you know, Cloudflare's moves in certain areas. With Peloton, like, what I would be excited to learn more about is again, how many subs is yoga as an entry point and treadmill as an entry point bringing on, right? And then also kind of thinking about, well, okay, knowing that, what if they came out with a, or acquired a weightlifting product or, you yeah. know, a, whatever, swimming, I don't know, whatever the other thing is, right?
Swimming Peloton would be impressive. You'd need the AR glasses that we were talking about.
Exactly, yeah. But, you know, like something like that. And then being able to understand how that would look to drive that sub growth. So those to me are the interesting point right now is we're at a point in the market where understanding how a company can leverage their existing market position and their existing distribution to move into product adjacencies is one of the most important things I think we can look at as investors right now. And by the way, founders are also looking at the same thing because what they're looking at is, hey, how do we exceed the valuation that we're getting that are fairly high at this point in the market? And so they're all starting to think about, well, maybe if I'm top down, I should start to think about what's a more, you know, bottoms up entry point for a potential product, right? Or is there a more efficient go to market I can engender somehow? Or, hey, I'm already talking with Coca-Cola on this one thing. They told me that they need to solve this other thing. You know what? I'm going to go buy a company in that space that's just getting started out. Maybe they're at the seed stage, right? Go and buy that tech, have those people come in, build out this product within our implicit distribution, and then all of a sudden we start to expand our adjacency, right? And start to expand to a larger TAM, a larger market potential.
Yeah. And then you get into these scenarios where, you know, somebody like me, when Zuckerberg buys Instagram, I say, oh, that's so stupid. And look at how dumb I look.
We all have those moments, man. Like I've had, you know, Microsoft buying LinkedIn. Oh my God. That was the dumbest call on my part. I was like, I don't get
it. It's a horrible product, but people do love it. But I can't stand LinkedIn. Maybe I'm just like biased towards Twitter.
I just didn't see what Microsoft was doing acquiring it, basically. I didn't understand how it would fit in. Like, but I mean, man, they have done just such an excellent job stewarding that company along since it's been under their ownership. So it's we're always wrong on these things.
What got you so excited about the Twilio acquisition?
Yeah, so you know what's interesting with Segment is it is what Twilio has proven with their multiple acquisitions and you know first they did SendGrid, right? And when they did SendGrid, it was pretty exciting, right? Because it was an email API product that you could see one how it could fit in really nicely too, and two it was also developer led, right? And product led growth. So you're like, okay. But I kind of worried about like, okay, well, what's Twilio going to do next? And how are they going to, you know, how are they going to integrate that? And two, how are they going to move forward and what are they going to acquire? And what they've clearly shown with their Segment acquisition is they're sticking to developer first. Like the next thing that they're going to buy is also going to be developer first. And so again, that's leveraging their inherent inside sales model that they already have. And it's leveraging the shared knowledge that they already have with these business models. And so because they're doing that, now I can start to see them expanding into, you know, there's certain things around security that they could be doing. There's certain things around, identity maybe. There's other areas that they can move into. Right now, they're kind of almost building like a bottoms-up CRM, frankly, like a Salesforce, to be honest,
yeah.
Where they have, these communication APIs. They have Segment itself, which allows you to take all... to take this customer data from all these different solutions, have it be in one place, and then be able to port those into whatever tools that you need. So what Segment provides is a really easy interoperable layer where if you're using Marketo and you want to move to, what would their exact target, or what, I don't know if that's the exact, but you know, if you're trying to move to another MarTech solution, Segment allows that to be very easily done so that you can just port on over. And so there's all these sort of things on the sales stack, the analytics stack, the marketing stack, where you can easily port this data over, but still have this central hub where everything's unified and you understand these personas so that you can, you know, better easily understand your customer data.
And I would think that being led by such a developer-focused CEO in that world, right? I would think developers think that guy's the man. Like if I was going to go work for somebody and like if Buffett, you know, a young Buffett, shoot, if an old Buffett called me, I'd be like, yeah, I'm there. Right. So it's like, I would think that, you have this natural reflexivity in the company, like in the character of the CEO that can attract talent. And then when that CEO can prove that they're able to move into adjacencies, there's in people businesses, like I do think there's serious reflexivity in that. And I do think that like momentum really, really matters. I don't know, you know, if that applies here, but I would think it does.
I think it does. And part of their culture too is getting people to think about that developer first mindset, right? So the CEO of SendGrid came in, I don't think he was a developer. On day one or, you know, whatever, the early days of when you joined Twilio, you have to actually build something using Twilio's API. And imagine how cool that is to see your CEO, who's been a go-to-market person, who's like, you know, great salesperson or whatever, and that's who you've looked up to, and now they're presenting something that they've coded, right?
Yeah.
Twilio's API. Like, that is wild. And that
yeah,
is,
that's cool.
Like, that would get me so jazzed up to see that. Like, I'd be fired up, and I'd be like, yeah, let's go. Like, you're building this? Like, let's go, you know?
Yeah, that's right.
And so
and culturally, you all start, right? At this, you all got a code. So it's like, all right, let's do this.
Yeah, and it's just also just like a fun thing, right? Because then you get to razz on the product and, you know, and he'll make fun of himself and, you know, so on and so forth. So I think that's the fun part, right, of having Jeff Lawson, more so him being like this person that everyone aspires to be or anything in the developer world. It's more about that culture that he's put up of like, mm-hmm. Hey, this is what we're going to do. Like, if you're a salesperson, you still got to create a Twilio API, you know, product with the Twilio API. That is really cool, right? And that gets everyone bought into the same culture.
Yeah, that is cool. I could see how that would create something enduring.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, you know, we'll see if others do that, right? Hackathons used to be something that Atlassian would do, right? Other companies would do it too. But like I would say, Atlassian did a really good job with these hackathons, coming up with new products and having that be a major cultural thing. Over time, though, that's become so effective that now if you know, it's kind of table stakes. Like every company has hackathons now, right? And so you lose some of those cultural competitive advantages over time, just like, you know, the coffee table and the coffee and ping pong table and all that sort of stuff. Like eventually those get commoditized. And so you have to think about these other ways that you're going to engender culture. So I think Jeff Lawson has done a great job of that, Twilio.
As a Facebook investor, do you get concerned? Because I heard you talk about in the past that everything at Facebook came back to the Blue App. Do you worry a little bit about Zuckerberg being so like tied to the Blue App that culturally that creates a problem or not really?
So while I would say yes, that does worry me, I would also say that the Instagram co-founders, Kevin Systrom and Mike Krieger, like they stayed at Instagram for 5 or 6 years. That is a pretty long freaking time for someone who just made $1 billion or, you know, whatever, a couple hundred million each to stay at a company, right? When you don't need to work anymore. And that's long past the golden handcuffs, right? You know, there's,
no doubt.
You know, so I think one of the things is absolutely, I read this book called No Filter, which is the story about Instagram acquisition. It was great and really interesting to learn about how Zuckerberg was prioritizing the Blue App and how that led to certain trade-offs and decisions. But at the same time, like the fact that the Instagram founders stayed for 5 to 6 years and continued to do their best and wanted to also means that Zuck's probably pretty good at motivating folks, right? And so I think there's this balance that it's not, there's no one narrative that can control that.
I have heard of a couple people that I know that got hired and then now they won't even talk to me about, if I mention the word Facebook, it's as if I like don't exist. So I don't know if they're worried that everything is tapped in their house or whatever, but there are very impressive people. I think the hiring that I've seen, at least on the engineering side, is quite impressive.
Yeah, the moves that they're making too in terms of Instagram and the partnership with Shopify and, you know, some of their recent acquisitions that they've announced is pretty exciting. And I think if people delve more into those, you know, the acquisitions and the things that they're talking about publicly and stuff, I think there's a really, really cool vision for how this could expand in the future and what I get excited about. So I think that's something where, if you do a little detective work, they're not hiding what they're trying to do. I can't really talk about it because, you know, one of the companies acquired was in our portfolio, but like it is a very exciting, potential outcome and strategy that they look to be formulating.
I hate that stock because I wrote it up when Boycott Facebook was going on. I think I bought it at like 150. I think I sold it at like 155 because I was like, no, there's too much terminal value risk for me. And then I think I did it again in March. I think I held it. And then I was like, I can't hold it. And now I hold it again. And I think I've got myself over the hump. But watch me lose money on this thing. I promise I'll be the guy that ends up losing money on Facebook. I deserve it. But I believe in it. But there is something about me that worries about terminal value in that entity. But Instagram's the best ad machine ever created. That thing is incredible.
Yeah, I mean, there's absolutely terminal value. You know, you could always make a bear case for Facebook pretty easily because the bear case is just, hey, what happens if all the young people go to TikTok and no one goes to Facebook, right? So you could, yeah. There's always an easy bear case to make, which is just like, hey, everyone's consumer attention could just shift elsewhere. I think that does a disservice though to Facebook, which has shown just how freaking good they are at continuing to figure out ways to grab our attention. And so, you know, again, that's where it comes down to management teams, to their ability to use the data that they have, the amount that they're investing in machine learning to kind of figure out different ways to engage their users. I think all of those are working. Like, I don't know about you, but like I logged onto Facebook the other day. I haven't been on there for a while. And I just got a bunch of like ESPN highlight reels, right? And I was like, whoa, this is great. Like, I didn't watch this NBA game. Like, oh my God.
I wanted.
You know, and all of a sudden I was like on Facebook for like, you know, probably not that long, but like, let's say like 15 minutes, just watching the ESPN clips, right? That I hadn't looked at. And you know, there's a reason that Facebook did that, right? Like they're not stupid. And that's the way that even someone like me who doesn't log on that often can get drawn in. And I actually, you know, I wrote about this. I posted a tweet recently, but I came out from that Facebook session having bought a pair of sneakers, these Noble sneakers. I don't even know, but they looked really cool. And also, I got this meal delivery plan called Factor. And literally, my fiance is like, what just happened? Like, you never do this. So I was like,
I don't know. I went into Facebook.
I was like, I don't know. I was watching ESPN and then like LeBron had some cool shoes and these cool shoes showed up and like, I don't know. I got that. And then I was like, oh, I want to eat better. And this Factor thing came up. And so, you know, that's the magic, I think, of what they're doing over there.
It's very smart. They show you LeBron and then they make you think that these shoes might change you in some way. And then, by the way, the diet could give you that body. I'll take it all.
I gotta imagine that's what they're doing, and unfortunately it won't work out for me that way, but at least I could try, you know.
I've been researching naked wines, so that's like everywhere. I don't know what they're gonna do. Maybe they'll show me a bunch of pictures of like fat old men that make me want to drink my sorrows away.
Have you bought anything on Naked Wines yet?
I have. I think that the problem that company may have is that I didn't like the first bottles that I bought. And if I was not interested in the investment case, I don't know that I would have given them a second chance. I will say that when I returned the bottles or said that I didn't like them, they gave me all my money back immediately. And now that I have like sort of trained it into what I like, I can get like really good cheap wine there. You know, and it's not, there's no friction. I don't have to go to the grocery store and, you know, they ping me $40 a month, which I don't use every month. But then if I ever wanted it back, I'd get it. And I think it's a pretty good mousetrap. I've said that I think it's the Carvana of wine. You know, I mean, if you like Carvana, you'll love this.
Oh, God.
But, you know, it's got... It's not perfect though, right? Because each state, so like where I am, I need to be there to sign when I get the delivery.
Oh, okay.
So that's a pain because then I got to plan on like what my day is going to look like to get wine, and I could just go to the grocery store to solve that problem. So I end up just driving to the UPS store to you know, pick it up, which I don't mind. But again, like if I wasn't interested in the company, I just, that might be the thing that I just say, whatever. On the other hand, like, I ordered from this competitor, Wine Access, and that's taken like a month. So Naked, they can ship it, and they can ship it efficiently, and they can get it to you quick. So there's something there.
I think, you know, what gets me excited about Naked, so I actually had the opposite experience where I was, I'm a little bit of a wine snob, just because I only like certain wines. Like I haven't really found many Pinots that I like. So when I found one Pinot, it happened to be quite expensive, but like that was literally the only Pinot that I would buy. Cause I was like, that's the only one that I like. Right.
And so that's right. That's what goes in my mouth is only this.
So I would just be like, I'm buying this one. Like if it's gotta be a Pinot, I'll buy this. Otherwise, like I can drink as many Syrahs or Cabs or whatever. I love those, but Pinots for some reason, I only like this one kind.
I get that.
So anyway, I bought, the starter pack, like, you know, the six wines that they offer from Naked Wines. They sent me this one Pinot, my whole family loved it. And just right there, they had me hooked. Like from that moment, the fact that they gave me that, I'm now hooked. What interests me about the business though, is there's some really low hanging fruit that now that they're completely focused on just this, you know, e-commerce marketplace business, essentially, they can do a lot of. What gets me excited is first of all, there's a ton of like UI UX tweaks that they can make that, frankly, I think improves the buyer experience. And I think as they do those, that will bring a lot more repeat purchases and also new consumers in. Because even when you look at the website right now, it's like this blue and white, like hodgepodge. It just looks cheap, right? It doesn't look good.
Yeah, it does look a little
cheap. Yeah, and so like imagine if they just put a little bit of effort into that, which I think they're doing now, the conversion should go up a decent amount, right? Once you have those UI UX tweaks, then you start moving into growth tactics, right? Which, you know, this is what Facebook's really good at, right? But it's like, you know, notifications, email marketing, it's ads in different places, right? And so there's all these different components to it that I think could be nice drivers in the future.
Dude, their email marketing is like really good. And I don't know if it's one of these, Tony Robbins has an exercise where he says like, look around your room, look at blue, 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 blue. Now close your eyes and tell me what's red. And you can't say you can't name one thing that's red, right? So it's very possible that like I'm interested in the investment, so I'm seeing the emails, but those emails show to me different than most spam emails. I actually think they're quite good at email marketing.
It could be. So now I'm going to actually start paying attention to the emails. To be fair, I'm interested in investment. I haven't actually looked at the emails. So
there you go.
So I don't know if that's the bear case for it, but,
it might be. I don't know.
But I think what's interesting about that is, again, if you think about a differentiated approach to a market that's existed for a while, wine has been there for a while. There's tons of different models out there. There's, you know, been some successful localized e-commerce efforts as well to do that, right? What's interesting to me, though, is they're taking this approach of going vertical, right? Working with these independent wineries, buying some of them, or I guess they used to own them, now striking partnerships with them, right? And being able to just focus on customer experience and what that looks like to you, right? And so I think to me, that's a huge differentiator versus what's out there right now, which is currently everyone's trying to brand themselves as we're, you know, from the French Valley that only does, you know, these grapes, or like we're from Napa or whatever. And then they mark up that premium. Versus these folks are just like, hey, listen, we're going to get you fast, cost-efficient wine, like, you know, at a level that you're okay paying with, but it's going to taste just as good as the other stuff that you're used to, and you'll learn some new brands out of it, right? And that, to me, gets pretty excited where that you could see a lot of consumer surplus being generated from that.
Yeah, I think the other thing that is, again, it's just whether or not people will engage enough with the product to train it. And I think that with like the Stitch Fix training some people in certain ways, there's evidence that consumers are willing to interact with apps. Once you train that app to what you like I logged on the other day and they said like, we don't think you'll like this, too sweet. We think you might like this. We think you might like this. And, you know, I bought a case of wine that I have a high degree of confidence and I'm going to like. I paid like $12 a bottle.
It's insane.
That's so much better than going to the grocery store, picking some $19 bottle that's probably got $7 juice in it that I'm going to end up hating. And by the way, if I don't like the Naked wines, they're going to refund all my money, right? Like not for all the bottles, but like if I really don't like a bottle, I'll say that. I left two reviews. The actual winemaker got back to me.
Wow.
I like the idea of the angel. It sort of engenders like this feeling of I'm supporting you. There's a lot of smart psychology in that product.
Yeah, I agree. But the low-hanging fruit to me, again, goes back to all those little things that you mentioned. Like they, you know, Stitch Fix has put so much money into their data science, right? Rightfully so, because they understood the payoff. I think up until this point, Naked Wines hasn't had the ability to, right? Because they've had this legacy wine business and vineyards and all this sort of stuff, and it's been all confused. Now that they're only focused on this area, there's a ton of stuff that they can do that has measurable, quick impact. Just from even, I don't know what their data infrastructure looks like, but I imagine like they probably don't have the cleanest data or like, you know, the best systems to ingest that data. Even those improvements have compounding effects very quickly, right? At the stage that they're at, where they're kind of not to say that they're like starting from a standing start, but like they are very early on, like, how to optimize e-commerce and how to optimize e-commerce websites. All these little things that they can do will lead to like, you know, 1%, 2% uplifts in conversion. And those uplifts in conversion, you know, have a massive payout, especially as you start to invest in, you know, content marketing.
Well, to your point on nonlinear thinking, if you can improve, call it 2% for 5 years, well, that's not a high enough improvement, but you know what I mean. Like, you can really get some margin improvement and some throughput through, like, they're, my understanding is that their distribution system can handle more volume. So you get enough little sort of tweaks and you can get a pretty interesting outcome. So I don't know. We'll continue to watch it. It'll be interesting to see. I think to your point, like adding cheese and stuff like that, if they can figure out how to ship it, but then you get a lot of complexity in the supply chain, so it's really not worth it. But there might be something that they can add. I don't know.
I think this is one of those ones where they don't necessarily need to add another category. I think they just need to improve at what they're doing. It's better UI UX. It's better growth marketing. It's better data ingestion and machine learning. And all of those will lead to increased conversion rates. And I will say this, like a 1-2% conversion rate, I don't know what their, you know, unique visitors to the website are right now, but a 1-2% lift on, you know, a million users is a lot of money.
Yeah.
You know, especially if they're early on in that and they haven't, you know, gotten a huge top of funnel yet. If they can make those tweaks now and then start to turn on the top of funnel engines, you could really quickly see this re-rate to a multiple that where other e-commerce, rightfully so, trades at, right? Where the Stitch Fixes, where the Farfetches of the world trade at in apparel. And something with wine, like where there's not as many competitors on a kind of national basis, I think it's a pretty attractive investment.
Yeah, I would agree, although this isn't investment advice.
Right. Well, yeah.
That is, but I agree with you. I think it's got some very interesting upside. And I think that the interesting thing about drinker data is the everyday drinker drinks a lot more than the not everyday drinker. And they're serving that person. So they're serving like a need for, you know, I mean, my grandfather, he drank every single night. And that dude could have drank a lot of nicer wines. He drank Yellowtail. I guarantee you that had Naked Wines existed, he'd have had like a case a week delivered to well, I might overstate how much he drank, but he didn't need to be existing on Yellowtail to feel like he wasn't wasting money. But
you know what? I'm still a Bud Light fan, and no matter how many premium beers come my way, the only other one that I really like is Yingling from Pittsburgh.
Oh, yeah?
And those are my two go-tos. And honestly, I'll go into a bar and like, they'll be like, oh, we've got this, you know, triple IPA from Sierra Nevada or something like that. And I'm just like, do you have Bud Light?
I can't take those IPAs anymore. I used to when I was younger. They go straight to the gut now. I'm like Coors Light or that's it. Do you like Bud Light Lime?
I'm not a big fan. I know you're a fan. I know.
One of them fast is excellent. More than that, it's not so great. I have promoted that in the past. All right, my man. Well, I know that you got a meeting coming up, so I'm going to let you go. But I really enjoyed this. I hope, you know, if you're willing to come back, you got an open invitation. It's evergreen.
I appreciate that. No, I love what you're doing with the podcast. Honestly, the guests have all been great. And I love that, you know, I think you had Jack on, and I'm forgetting his last name, but
Yeah, Roerbeck.
Yeah, and you had him on recently, and that was one of the most fascinating conversations with someone that I frankly would not have been introduced to without, you know, you bringing him up. So, you know, someone who's been in, like, he was in the candle business and he was in, like, all these other businesses, like, just so fascinating to hear how he talked about it. And then also take those learnings and be like, okay, there's interesting parallels to enterprise software that I could think about. So really want to say thanks for bringing, you know, some of these folks to all of our attention.
Well, man, I brought him on specifically so that people like you would like it. I did not know how many people would get to the end, but there've been a couple people that I really respect that reached out and said, this is actually one of my favorite episodes so far. And that was super fun. If you, you know, if you want him to talk to anybody, he's not very good at retirement. That guy likes to work. So he's happy to coach people up. He's itching to get back to work. I'm like, Jack, calm down.
I love that. I may be reaching out to you for a connection to him at some point. So appreciate that.
Well, I mean it.
But I love it. Keep it up with the podcast. This is amazing stuff. And thanks for doing what you're doing.
I will, man. I'll do it until it starts to suck and then I'll take a break.
All right.
All right, take care of yourself.
All right, I'll see you.